philosophers think more clearly than you do, then it's an honor and a challenge to be asked to speak in front of philosophers. And it's also an honor and also a challenge to be invited to speak by students, because students have no professional obligations and have no ulterior motive. And hopefully are also looking forward. They're the hardest people to impress. Okay, so having said that, I'm completely intimidated. What I'm going to try to do in this talk is talk about what is the key issue, where current directions in theoretical physics and the philosophical tradition in thinking about physics meet. And this is in the issue of what space and time are, and more particularly in what philosophers call the debate between about relationalism, whether space and time are relational or absolute, which is an old debate in the philosophical tradition. And I'm not going to try to teach you anything about that, because at least, and I'm also aware that there are some philosophers of science in the audience, but you're not solely philosophers of science. So I have tried to explain the technicalities, assuming that people have not seen them before. And if I don't succeed, then just stop and interrupt and ask. I should say the tradition among theoretical physicists for presentation is much more informal than the tradition among philosophers. So we don't mind being interrupted in the middle, and we don't mind at all questions of the form of, I don't understand what that is, or could you explain that? We also mind, but put up with questions of the form of, are you completely nuts? How can you possibly say that? So either is welcome. In the philosophical tradition about space and time, going back to the days when people were smart enough that you could distinguish who was a philosopher and who was a physicist, there was a debate about whether space and time were relational or absolute. The cartoon history is that there was Newton, who was an absolutist, and there was Leibniz, who was a relationalist, and they had a debate. And Leibniz won, but it didn't affect the progress of science or the direction of science. And so the debate had to be revisited. And eventually, the issues were formulated by Mach at the late 19th century in a way that got through to a kid called Einstein, who figured out how to do what Leibniz wanted to do. At least that's the cartoon version. What I'm going to do is, I'm not going to address the historical issues. I'm going to discuss how it is that the matter, the question of whether space and time are absolute or relational, plays a role in contemporary research in theoretical physics, and particularly having to do with the question of quantum gravity, which is both about the foundations of quantum mechanics, is making sense of quantum mechanics, and about incorporating within quantum theory the version of space and time that we have from Einstein's general theory of relativity, or vice versa. But that's not all I'm going to talk about. So there's my outline. So first I'm going to talk about what does a physicist mean when we talk of relationalism. And we actually don't use that language. The language that we use is background independent for what philosophers call relational, and background dependent for what philosophers call absolute. But with that translation, the debate continues among specialists, and I'm going to basically explain how we think about the issue and how we use it. And Eli, you were supposed to be helping me prevent that from happening. What? Where? There was nothing that said it. Anyway, if I pay attention to it often, more often as I will when I'm going through the talk, I think it'll be fine. Then I'm going to talk about general relativity, and and describe briefly why, and I believe that this is the consensus view among physicists who are philosophically sophisticated or claim to be, it may not be the consensus view among professional philosophers of physics, that general relativity is partly, and something explicitly is meant by that, an instantiation of Leibniz's relational view. And then I'm going to talk about how relational space and time are described in the quantum theory of gravity. And indeed, that construction was very influenced by the philosophical history. And I'll mention when I get to it how. And then there are some more speculative things if I get to them, or three topics if I get to it. One of them is a general discussion of the relationship between reductionism and relationalism. Then the relationship to Darwin and biology, which I think is centrally important to an understanding of how relationalism is central not only to physics but to other areas of science. And then how the notion of relationalism has influenced some people thinking about the foundations of quantum mechanics to the point where there's a set of proposals for the interpretation of quantum mechanics which are called relational quantum mechanics. Okay, so that's my outline. But I don't mind being interrupted, and I don't mind if we don't get all the way through. I'm telling you my punchline at the beginning, and this is my main theme and punchline, which is that we should believe relationalism. So I am an advocate of relationalism, not just because there are better arguments for it from Leibniz and so on, which I believe there are, but I'm only an amateur philosopher, but because it leads to theories that are more successful in two related ways. The theories are more predictive and falsifiable, and they're tighter, they're more highly constrained. And therefore, they're better theories. So that's the main claim, that relational theories are, in the long run, more successful physical theories because they're less arbitrary, more constrained, and hence more falsifiable. Okay? And I believe there are three examples of that theme. One of them is how relationalism has played itself out in quantum gravity. One is the issue of unification of particle physics and a complete theory of quote, everything, and then with the issue of quantum theory. Okay. So what do we physicists mean when we talk of relationalism? Well, a key fact, which is never mentioned or hardly ever mentioned, but is the key fact behind the whole thing, is that the world is really big and complicated. Okay? If the world were like the systems we study in the classroom, which just have, you know, a particle moving in two-dimensional or three-dimensional space, if that was nature, relationalism would be unnecessary. Okay? The whole point is that we deal with the world with many degrees of freedom, many particles in it, or many degrees of freedom in fields, if you like, enormous complexity, and in terms of events, enormous multitude of events. Okay. So how do the elementary entities, whatever they are, whether they're events, as in space-time theories like relativity or particles, how do they get their properties? Because a theory attributes properties to particles or little entities in the big world, and the key question is where do those properties come from? In an absolute scenario like Newtonian mechanics, here's the way it goes. There's a background, for example, the three dimensions of space and the smooth flow of time, and a particle gets its properties by its relation to that absolute background. It has a position with respect to that absolute space, and an event maybe where it meets another particle at some position happens at a time relative to absolute time, which is just believed to be some real number which is continuously growing that you have access to everywhere. Okay? Hence, the particles have nothing to do with each other. A particle has the same properties and gets them the same way, whether it's the only particle in the universe, whether there's 3 or 5 particles in the universe, or 10 to the 80 particles in the universe. Each one gets its properties independently of all the others through its relation to the absolute background. Okay? And the background, another word for it, is the absolute entities. These are entities which are unchanging, which are non-dynamical, but which are necessary in such a scenario to give meaning to the properties of the entities that are dynamical. Okay. Now, the most basic statement of relationalism is to reject that strategy for giving entities properties. And just to make the statement, there is no background. Okay. So what are the consequences of that statement? The relational view posits that the fundamental properties of the entities of the world consist entirely on relationships between them, on properties that are, and what do we mean by relationship? A property that's shared by two, or a set, or a larger set of such entities. So we never, from a relational point of view, there's no background, so a particle has no position. But there might be a distance between two particles, for example, in a simple instantiation of it. By the way, those of you who are not philosophers of science, but might be philosophers of social science or ethics or something like that, may be aware, but in case you're not, I'll clue you in, and here's a way you can entertain yourself through this boring science talk, is that there are precisely parallel discussions in philosophy of law, philosophy of ethics, that follow precisely the same logic. And if I were smarter, if I were able maybe to be a real philosopher, that would be a question that I would investigate. Because that is just something that I know enough to have discovered that. But why that is, I think, is really a philosophical question. Okay. So that's the second statement of relationalism. I'm calling it R2. And here are some examples of purely relational system. So the example of a purely absolute system, the paradigmatic example, is a particle moving in three-dimensional space that Newton described. Here are paradigmatic examples of relational systems. A graph. A graph consists of n vertices, and the entire properties that a vertex has is the set of other vertices that it's connected to by a link. And the graph is a picture of a system of properties which are entirely relational. And in fact, what I really mean by the graph is that even that the nodes don't, there's a list of the properties between the nodes, but the nodes themselves have no identity apart from the system of relations. So what I would mean by my definition of a graph would say, following Leibniz's principle of the identity of the indiscernible, that if there are two nodes which I distinguish by the graph as being different, okay, then if I look at neighborhoods of them, the neighborhoods of them are non-isomorphic. Okay. And if I have a graph with symmetry such that that's not the case, I would not call that a proper graph. Okay. So what I mean is entirely just by the picture of a system of relations, we attribute properties to the nodes there. Here's another, it's a partially ordered set. So, for example, there are a set of causal relations. An arrow might signify some causal process occurred, okay? And the relations between the arrows, signified by the tail of one starting at the head of another, is that this causal relation gave rise to these other causal relations. And from the graph, you can also talk about events, which are incidences, you know, where a head and a tail, or several heads and several tails meet. But basically, it's a set of relations amongst causal processes indicated by arrows. And mathematically, All that I need to do is draw you a picture of some arrows and which heads are connected to which tails. Now, two things. One, why I'm showing you these is that these are the structures that are the relational structures in at least a certain version of quantum gravity. So we'll be coming back. A second reason is that somebody that I want to mention and honor, who is the person who was the kind of guru who transmitted the philosophical tradition about space and time to those of us working on quantum gravity, at least people from a few years older than me and younger, is something called Julian Barber. And a lot of this way of talking about the whole thing is from, it comes from him. And okay, so those are two systems of relations. Here's a partly relational system, knots. Why is it partly relational? Because it depends on the topology. A knot is embedded, say a link, which is two loops, linked like that, is embedded in the topology of a three-dimensional space. And one makes assumptions, for example, that the topology of a three-dimensional space is a three-sphere or is a three-torus or something before you can describe the system of possible knots and links. And that plays the role of an absolute structure. But then given that you fix the topology of three-dimensional space, there are many different knots and links, in fact, an infinite number of them. A link is a knot is a closed loop which cannot be untangled, which is topologically inequivalent to just a circle in three-dimensional space. A link is a set of such closed loops, which are sort of topologically distinct. There are actually, up to topological equivalence, there are an infinite number of knots and links, and there is a mathematical subject that studies them. And it's almost purely a system of relations, but there is a fixed background, which is the topology. So we say that it's a partly relational system. Okay? Is it clear how? And notice the key point is that this is for real. It's not like what like a Leibnizian system, which I would use as a slang for a relational system, is not just a little, is not like a Newtonian system or an absolute system plus something, some little tweak. They're very different. A particle in three-dimensional space, as Newton perceived it, the point of three-dimensional space it's at has absolute meaning. That absolute physical meaning, it's a important property of it. Any particular arrow in a partially ordered set or any particular node in a graph has no properties if you took it outside of that system. Its properties entirely come from the system of relations. Therefore, how you do physics is very different. If you're Newton, how you do physics is you give laws for particles to move around relative to the absolute background. If you're working with these structures, you give laws or rules for the system of relations to evolve, to change in time. Which brings me to the next point. What is time in a relational theory? And in a relational theory, time is nothing but the causal ordering among changes in the system of relations. So if I turn on or off a link in a graph, that's an event. And then I can turn on or off another one. Or if I change a knot by winding something around, then I can change it again, and then I can change it again. But there's causal relations amongst those events, because sometimes what you do, the change you make to the system of relations is only possible because of previous changes to the system of relations. And the claim is that time is nothing but necessary relations, which are relations akin to causality, which by the structure of the system of relations hold between the changes to the system of relations. And again, this is very different from Newton, where in Newton, if nothing happens, if everything just sits there, time still goes on just the same. Here, it's incoherent to even discuss whether if nothing happens, quote, time goes on. Okay. Now, relationalism is also, that is what relationalism is for physicists. It also should be emphasized that it's a research strategy. It's not just some absolute yes or no thing. And by a research strategy, I mean we are given by the stage of development of science that we enter, okay, a certain set of laws, a certain set of theories. And if you're a relationalist, if you believe that relationalism is true, then our job is to make the laws of physics more relational. And more relational means identify, and the strategy, therefore, is identify some structure, right, which is background, that is in the present formulation, does not evolve, and is fixed and is required to give meaning to the properties of things that do evolve. Identify some set structure which you can replace by an evolving system of relations, as Einstein did for the notion of space. Okay? And that's a strategy which has succeeded a few times, but it has a long way to go. For example, it's easy to identify in present physics structures that are absolute. For example, Hilbert space, the structure of Hilbert space is an infinite dimensional or a large finite dimensional vector space with a certain complex metric on it, it just sits there, ripe to be replaced by something dynamical and evolving. And again, there are analogous strategies in social theory and legal theory. Okay. So, to summarize, those are the three statements that constitute for physicist relationalism, and there is also the relational strategy. There is no background. In the absence of a background, properties between elementary entities or systems of relations and times are necessary relationships between changes in the systems of relations. And time is a history of such changes. Okay, now I said this in my opening remarks. Contemporary theoretical physicists, being badly educated, fell into a debate which is the old absolute relational debate, but since most of us weren't aware of that, we invented other terms and we call it the background dependent versus the background independent approaches to theoretical physics. And there is a raging debate between people who are happy trying to do fundamental physics with fixed backgrounds and people who see what they're doing as following that strategy and eliminating the background. So this is, so the debate is at least as hot and active as it was in the cartoon history moment between the followers of Leibniz and Newton. And as essential. Is there a question? So you want to know how space emerges from that kind of description? Well, I'll get there. I didn't say it's all easy. Okay. Now, let me just discuss general relativity in these terms. Just to set some language, and then I'll talk about quantum gravity. And by the way, my guess is that that's all I'll get to say before you've absorbed enough. So general relativity is actually a very complicated theory. I remember another guru of relationalism in physics, David Finkelstein, I remember him saying that to me, that, and this is the way that he used to put things, and probably still does, that, you know, God would never make the world that way because it's so complicated. To make a description of space-time in general relativity, you have to choose a dimension. Then you have to choose a topology or a manifold. Then you have to put down what's called a differential structure, which you may or may not know what it is, but it's basically an infinite system of maps from pieces of the manifold to Euclidean spaces that allows you to do calculus on this construction that you're making. And you have to, like, it's like a graduate course in mathematics to really learn how to even say that properly. And then on top of that, you have to put this structure, which is called the metric, which tells you how to measure distances or how to define causal relations. And you have other fields as well, like the electromagnetic field and the neutrino field and the electron field and the quark field. And then you put that whole thing together and you put some laws on it. So it's a complicated construction, which probably means it's not true, it's just an approximation to something that's true. And therefore, all that we're really interested in for this is the fundamental issue of, is it a relational or an absolute theory? Well, it's both. Because the first things on my list, the dimension, the topology, and the differential structure, if you don't know what the differential structure is, just ignore it. Don't evolve. They're fixed once and for all in Einstein's theory. There are people who have fantasies about they do some version of quantum gravity where topology changes and stuff like that, but it doesn't, and it never works, okay? And it doesn't work because the theory that they're quantizing those things are not dynamical. So to make a description of the world in general relativity, you fix those things, but the last set of things, the metric, which tells you what distances are, what inertial frames are, what causal structure is, does evolve and the fields evolve. Okay. Now the key thing is that you're not done then. If you give the dimension, the topology, the differential structure, the metric, and the fields, okay, you don't have a description of the space-time. Because a fiction is created by the construction, which is that that manifold is a set consisting of an uncountable number of points on which they're defined these functions and so forth. And the points are in there. But points, if you're a relationalist, have no physical meaning. And Einstein was a relationalist. So what do you have to do? What you do is you introduce an infinite set of equivalence relations amongst those models. And those equivalence relations are basically that you call two such models equivalent if they differ by taking the points here and sliding them around so it looks like the points here. And the only thing that remains invariant under that are physically meaningful relationships between events. And such a thing is called a diffeomorphism. So diffeomorphism is a smooth map, to say it a little bit more precisely, from the manifold to itself. And the only property it has is that if you're able to define the derivatives of functions beforehand, you're able to define the derivatives of functions after. And so it's an infinite, very, very infinite set of relations between all those models discussed at the top. Okay? And general relativity asserts that a physical space-time is an equivalence class of those models under those equivalence relations. And that move is how general relativity is a relational theory. Because two models that would agree about everything that a relationalist would care about, that is, what are the causal relations between events particularly, but disagree about everything else, what are the values of the functions, what are the points where the events are happening on the manifold, those two models are deemed to be physically equivalent. Okay. I know I'm talking too long on one slide if that happens. Okay. So what information is actually coded in those equivalence classes? Okay. First, there are no points and there are no fields. Now this is disturbing, because they don't actually tell you this when you take general relativity in graduate school or undergraduate school. Now, you need a guru like Julian Barber to explain this to you. It's a shock the first time you learn it. But this is the real thing. And if you want to partake of the philosophical or historical argument about why this is really what Einstein wrote down, we can do that afterwards. So there are no fields, there are no points. The causal structure is invariant. That is, the system of which events could be said to be to the causal future, causal past, or unrelated is invariant. And what's called the measure, roughly speaking, if I look at a region of space-time, there's a property which is its volume, and that's invariant. Roughly speaking, if you think discretely, you could think that's sort of the number of events. It's a continuous measure of how much is going on in that volume, and that's invariant. And it's a theorem, which I'm not going to discuss, but I'll just mention, that if you give in a spacetime the set of the causal relations and the volume of regions, you completely fix the information in those equivalence classes. Now, maybe that's how we should give them. We don't actually give them that way because we're dumb. And this is one of a set of cases in which the actual mathematical description we use requires setting up some huge structure, then modding out by a huge equivalence class. And we don't have actually a clean way to mathematically model the result. So we have to go through all of this every time we do general relativity. Okay? So that's the way that a relationalist thinks of general relativity, and I think it's the right way. Okay. Now, there's good reason to believe, besides the fact that it's a mess conceptually and formally, as you see, that general relativity is not the right theory. The main reason is quantum mechanics, which somehow both of them are theories of principle. We want one theory of principle, not two, not quantum theory and general relativity. Okay. So there are different strategies, and one strategy is called background-dependent strategies, in which people give up relationalism. They fix one solution of the Einstein's equations, and they quantize degrees of freedom moving in that one solution of the Einstein equations using the same methods that people use in quantum theory when gravity is not an issue. Okay? And that includes perturbative quantum general relativity, string theory, and a variety of other attempts. Okay? And then the other strategy is the background independent strategy, where you take the relational nature of general relativity as the essential message, and you try to make a quantum theory of space and time which is relational. And there are approaches to that include causal set models, which are pursued by Raphael Sorkin, Faye Dauker, and other people, loop quantum gravity, which some of us are still pursuing for some reasons I can't understand, and something called dynamical triangulations or causal dynamical triangulation. And so, and the interesting thing is, if there are any people sociologically interested, is that both of them are very active. Both strategies are owned by very active communities that misunderstand each other all the time. Okay. So I'm going to talk about a couple of those approaches and their difficulties. And then I'll be done, I think. This is the causal set approach of Raphael Sorkin and Faye Dauker collaborators. A causal set is a finite partial order, so it's a set of events related by causal relations, which are indicated by arrows. It's a discrete system, so the hypothesis is that space-time is fundamentally discrete and consists of discrete events and relations between them. And a space-time history is nothing but the set of causal relations. And the claim is that all there is in nature is a set of causal relations amongst events, where the events have no properties except the causal relations amongst them. So the events are not about anything, the causal relations are not about anything. The elementary properties are just the causal relations. That's the hypothesis of these people. It's a very bold hypothesis. And to make quantum mechanics out of it, they use one of the forms of quantum mechanics that ascribes probability amplitudes to history, so they don't tend to work in Hilbert spaces with operators. They tend to work with histories of path integral formulations of quantum mechanics. And they subscribe rules which ascribe amplitudes to the histories, and then they try to do what Feynman advised and sum over them. Okay. So the motivation, I really already said, the motivation is that the relational content of general relativity is already known to be in the causal relations amongst events in the volume element, and it's already there, because if I have a set of events On the volume, I can count how many events are in this region of the history, so that gives me a notion of volume, and the causal relations are there explicitly. So they claim the following. Okay? They claim that there's a notion by which a classical space-time, and I never got the point of it, but a classical space-time could be approximated by a causal set, and maybe there isn't a point of it, but the important thing is the definition there, and just get the drift if it's too technical. A causal set, which is one of these discrete sets of causal relations, approximates a space-time, that is a system of manifold and a metric, which we're describing, when there is an embedding, and the picture is as good as the words, that takes the discrete events, each one gets mapped to an event in the relativistic space-time. Each event has a light cone given by the metric, and those light cones determine causal relations amongst the images of those events, and they should match the discrete set. And then if one can do that, we say that the discrete causal set is a discrete approximation to the solution of Einstein's equation. And it can be shown that there are algorithms to construct such approximations. But there's a big problem, which we call the inverse problem. And the inverse problem is that every classical space-time can be approximated by a causal set, and in many ways, so there's no problem going that way. But the hypothesis of this theory is that that's not the way it goes in nature. The hypothesis of the theory is that the causal set, the discrete set of causal relations, is the prior and fundamental things. So you want the arrow to go the other way. And that's the inverse problem, because almost no system of discrete causal relations approximates any solution of Einstein's equations of any dimension, of any low dimension, I should say. I'm thinking here that the dimension should be much smaller than the number of events. If the dimension is equal to the number of events, you can always fake it. Okay? But of course, we believe the world has 10 to the 80 particles, which are having events all the time for billions of years, and there's only three dimensions of space. Okay? So do you see it? That in pictures is the success and the failure of a research program, of a current research program. Okay. And I don't know if Raphael is a visitor here, and we certainly have discussed this many times. He, of course, would not put it as strongly as I put it. And he would say, yes, but there is a validity. And maybe. And if they can make it work, it will be not only a triumph of relationalism, but a triumph of reductionism to the unbelievable degree, okay, because every property of everything in the world will just be reduced to there are undefined events except that they have causal relations amongst them. Okay, so it's an incredibly bold research program. It makes string theory look like, you know, a playground construction or something. Okay? Now, in fact, this inverse problem afflicts many research programs. There are a large number of people in the field of quantum gravity who pursue a research program that starts with the world is really discrete. The history of the world is really discrete. And here is what I think it is. It's causal relations or graphs or networks or something. Okay. And there's, you know, this Planck scale, which is given by the dimensional constants h bar g and the speed of light, which is 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. So if you study at that scale, you're going to see this discrete structure. And there's lots of beautiful work which is done. And it always goes this way. It's easy to take some smooth geometry and approximate it with a discrete structure. It's easy to say, I have a cylinder, and here's a graph, which gives a kind of discrete structure which approximates cylinder, or whatever you like. Okay, but once you get into the category of the systems of relations that you like, whether it's graphs or causal relations or networks or whatever, okay, you can go one way, but you can't go the other way. Okay. Maybe the world really is continuous. I don't know the answer to I'm very willing to speculate during the question session. Because I'm guilty of this. I work on a program here called Loop Quantum Gravity, which has the problem. I don't want to pretend it doesn't. But just to say what loop quantum gravity does, because it's relevant for this relational absolute structure, the other programs that I've been talking about just posit ab initio some structure which is hypothesized to be the discrete structure, in the same way that some person might have hypothesized, and certain people did, that matter really consists of atoms, just ab initio. What happened in loop quantum gravity is that one can actually derive discrete structure by applying the rules of quantum mechanics to the laws of general relativity. So assuming that you have some gravitational theory which is roughly like general relativity, it doesn't have to be the same content of matter, doesn't have to be the same laws, but is set up the same way in terms of equivalence classes under different work systems with metrics and fields, assuming that the topology and dimension of the space of space is fixed, then you can apply a method of quantization, and you get some basic, beautiful results, which I'm actually going to skip through, because this is not a propaganda talk. I put them in when I was feeling more in that mood. But there's a set of robust results where a discrete structure comes out, which, roughly speaking, is a combination of the three discrete structures that I showed you. That is, states are identified with graphs, which are also knotted and linked to each other, and they evolve by local moves, and those local moves make a set of causal relations. So what comes out of the quantization of general relativity unifies, there are lots of good things, but the good things are amazing, but there are some buts, and I want to talk about the buts. Is that okay? You don't mind? We just skip that stuff. So first, there's the problem of the classical limit, which has a lot to do with that inverse problem I said. Find the quantum state, that's the question you were asking. You find the quantum states, which should be like the vacuum state or the ground state of the theory, which should have the property that some coarse-grained description of it should look like classical general relativity. Okay? Do science. This is real life, this is real science, and real science means that you should make predictions for real experiments. And I'll come back to that in a minute. And remove the remaining background dependence. That is, there already, as I emphasized, general relativity is partly relational and partly absolute. There is a fixed background of dimension and topology and so forth. Remove it. And that's the challenge. Okay. So there's only one piece of good news, of really good news. And the one piece of really good news, and I just mentioned this because it would be inaccurate to give a talk about the state of this field without mentioning it, is that there are experiments. And the experiments, roughly speaking, work the following way. So if you know a little physics, you know that what's that formula? It's the relationship between energy and momentum and mass, if you just take the first three terms, of a particle in special relativity. Okay. Now, if a particle is moving through a medium, like air or water, there are corrections to that formula that come from the particle scattering off of the matter in the medium, the atoms in the medium. And those corrections might look like the next term, some constant, a length, the energy cubed, plus terms which are of higher order in the energy and in the momentum. And they come from interactions between the particle and the medium, and they result in dispersion and all the phenomena associated with dispersion of light in material. Now, if the structure of space-time is really discrete, then one should expect such effects as well. where that length LP is the Planck length I talked about, 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. And it turns out, we used to say, and this is a very interesting example of the sociology of science, all of us in this field said for as many years as the field existed, so 5 years ago, there are no experiments, we can't envision any experiments, it's just pure thought. Actually, we were wrong. There are experiments which you can do with present technology which probe for dispersion caused by discrete structure in space and time. And maybe for this audience, that's all I need to say about that. There are one experiment is called Auger, which is being done now in Argentina with high-energy cosmic rays. An experiment called GLASS, which analyzes cosmic ray bursts, is going up. The only thing that I have to explain is that there are very tiny effects, but we see photons and protons that have traveled for 10 billion years, and so the universe can act as an amplifier of very tiny effects to make them observable. And that's what's happening. Okay, so I've sort of skipped through the details, but here is what I think are the lessons. So there are several background-independent quantum theories of gravity. There is one which is in some sense the most successful because it's derived in a very clean way from taking general relativity and quantum mechanics together. And remarkably, it uses all the interesting structures that were in prior attempts to make a background-independent quantum theory of gravity. It's partly relational in exactly the same way that general relativity is partly relational. Some structure, like the dimension of space and the topology of space, has to be fixed in advance. The rest of the geometry of space and time evolves dynamically, and that's true in both cases. The main problems that it faces have to do with this inverse problem that I mentioned, and the inverse problem also has to do with getting rid of the rest of the background structure. So you should have to tell the theory what the dimension and the topology of space are. That should come out of the network of relations. But even so, the theory is making some predictions, and those predictions are being tested, will have been tested by, say, 5 or 6 years from now. And I haven't been able to think of a non-technical reason why, but the intuition is that working with the relationalism, making the relationalism the center of the quantization, restricts the options for making the theory work, and hence leads to a situation where there are predictions. So that's that's the lesson that I draw. Whereas the background-dependent, non-relational approaches, like string theory, and I have a few minutes to go on to that, so I will go on and discuss that issue, do not make predictions. And I am conjecturing that the deep reason is that they don't take relationalism seriously, and therefore they have, for with whatever level of success they have, there are too many options. And to get to that, I need to talk about reductionism. So a little segue about reductionism, which is a topic that philosophers know more about than I know about. But my reason for talking about reductionism is to come back and talk about, and to examine my, if you like, the conjecture I'm putting forward, that relational theories are tighter and are more falsifiable. Okay. Now, there's common sense reductionism, which I'm not going to disagree with, of course. Common sense reductionism is that when a system has parts, if you want to understand the system, it's a good idea to know what the parts are, to know what properties the parts have, and to understand the properties of the system in terms of how it's constructed from the parts. Of course, there are important issues about emergence of properties, and I'm not trying to ignore those, but I'm going to take that basic common sense reductionism as unproblematic. Because for fundamental physics, the issue is, fine, that works, but what do you do when you get to the things that the theory says has no parts? Because the strategy of reductionism is that you understand the property of an entity X by knowing how you take it into its parts, and its properties come from the properties of its parts. Okay? So what do you do when you get to the things that the theory asserts are elementary? You cannot apply the strategy of reductionism to them. But in the theories we have, like the standard model of elementary particle physics, the things that the theory claims are elementary have lots of properties. They have charges, they have masses, they have, well, and even apart from the properties that have to do with motion in space, which has to do with the theory of space-time, like position and momentum and so forth, they have lots of properties having to do with charges and other conserved quantities. It's quite complicated. So where do those properties come from if they're not made of parts? Okay. So there are two options, and this is repeating a little bit just the definition. In the background dependent theory, the properties have to come from a more detailed description of the relationship of the entity to the background, because properties of entities come from their relationship to the background. So if a thing has a complicated list of properties and it's supposed to be elementary, the background has to be complicated. And roughly speaking, that's why in string theory you have to add extra dimensions to try to reproduce particle physics, because you've got to get back enough background structure in to give properties, all the complex properties that people see that things have. In a background independent theory, the properties of entities which are claimed to be elementary can only come from their relation to each other. So it's a very different research strategy. I mean, I think that that problem, where do the properties of the elementary particles come from, is the key problem in what's called elementary particle physics. And there are two very different research strategies depending on which strategy you took about space and time. Okay. Now, here's what's happened. Most of the field, and this is, until I began to think about this a few years ago, this was certainly, I believed all this stuff. It's very easy to believe what I'm about to say. Okay. The main strategy following the background dependent route has been to look for two things, to try to develop the theory in two ways. One of them is unification. Given two things which are different, say the electric, this is the canonical example, the electric field and the magnetic field, try to make them different aspects of one entity. And of course, the paradigmatic example is Maxwell unified electric fields and magnetic fields into the theory of electromagnetism. And what particle physicists have been seeking to do is reduce all the different kinds of elementary particles, say quarks and electrons and neutrinos, to different states of one entity. And to try to reduce the four different forces to different manifestations of one force. That's the strategy of unification. The more particular strategy is symmetry. That is, find some mathematical structure where some symmetry group acts, okay, which ties these things together, which transforms the different states to each other that you, quote, unify. Okay? Now, these were tried and failed. From the 1920s to the 1950s, Einstein and a number of other people, Kaluza, Klein, Hermann Weyl, some of them particularly Hermann Weyl, great mathematicians, tried the strategy, and it failed to give the entities enough properties and to give room to unify them. They went to higher dimensions and introduced higher dimensions, and it failed. And it failed for two reasons. One thing is that when you unify things, they tend to want dynamically, if the electron and a quark are different states of the same particle, then there are going to be processes that transform one state to the other. That's what unification means. Okay. If the electromagnetic field is just a property of a hidden dimension of space, then there are going to be processes by which those hidden dimensions of space want to grow big and participate in the rest of space. So any theory with has dynamics and unification wants to have processes by which the things that are unified transform to each other. And if those things are not observed, you're in trouble, because these are the characteristic predictions such a theory said. The characteristic prediction of Maxwell is there are processes by which electric fields transform from magnetic fields and vice versa, and that's light. That is what light is. It's an alternating electric and magnetic fields generating each other. If you unify electrons and quarks, protons should decay. And either you see that, or you get involved in a strategy of hiding the implications of what you did, which is what particle physics has been doing. The strategy was tried once, and it was dead by the mid-50s, and string theory, in a certain sense, is a revival of the strategy. There's a big hope behind the strategy, and I think it's a history of science, philosophy of science question, where this hope comes from and what justifies it. The big hope is that if you could succeed in having a consistent, mathematically consistent theory that unifies all the forces and particles we know about, it must be unique. I was told that over and over again when I was in graduate school. That's what we were looking for, the unique, unified theory. At the present juncture, as I'll explain, none of us can remember why we believed that. But 20 years ago, and back through the rest of the 20th century, everybody in my profession believed that. I have no idea why. And I think it's an interesting question whether there was ever a genuine argument for that belief. OK, what's the present evidence? The evidence is that string theories, which do unify all the particles and forces with each other, and very beautifully, and in a way, I mean, it makes a strong case for itself by how beautifully and elegantly it so unifies things. The present evidence is that there are at least 10 to the 500 distinct such theories, which if any one of them is consistent, the others, consistency has not been proved for any of them, but the conjecture is that they are all consistent, and the evidence is that they're equally consistent. Now, there's a problem, which is that most of them are not understood in any detailed sense at all. They're just conjectured. And unfortunately, the much smaller number that can be studied in any detail yield predictions which disagree with observation. And those which are conjectured to agree with observation are impossible to study with present techniques. Okay? That's the present situation. Here's the way I want to put it, we made a philosophical mistake. My guess is that there is no good philosophical or a priori, no good philosophical argument, by which I mean no good argument that would stand up to scrutiny by philosophers, for the big hope. And we all believed it. We spent several generations of thousands of people on developing it, and we reached a reducto ad absurdum, which is the opposite conclusion, that if we have one theory, we have 10 to the 500 theories. And we don't know even if we have one theory. But if we do, we have 10 to the 500. OK? Don't laugh. This is serious stuff. Another big hope, same kind of story. The more you unify, the bigger the symmetry is, because there are more transformations in the things, the more unique it should be. And hence, the fewer freedom, the fewer free parameters. Physical theories have free parameters that you can adjust, like what is the mass of the electron, or what's the strength of the electric charge of the electron. These are parameters that you can adjust. What's the result? The standard model of elementary particle physics, which is the best empirically tested theory that's ever been constructed, has everything in it except gravity, and agrees with every experiment made to date. It was written down in 1973, I believe, has 23 parameters. The next, I believe, there's a certain kind of symmetry called supersymmetry, which means you do a very beautiful thing, which is you unify the particles and the forces in a certain sense. The simplest such theory has 105 parameters. And as I've said, the next step, which is to unify those with gravity, the simplest version of that we know of, which is string theory, comes in 10 to the 500 versions. So again, it's turning out exactly the opposite of our expectation. Okay. Why? Well, my belief is that by following constructions which do not take relationalism seriously, we are making a kind of reducto ad absurdum. And here is the last step, which is seriously advocated, which is that it's called the anthropic principle. There are advanced number of theories, but it's not too hard to cook up scenarios in which there are a vast number of universes, and in which the theories assigned to those universes would be random. Therefore, if there are so many theories, there must be one which has the properties of our universe. Therefore, the theory is true. Okay? Now, that, and again, smile, laugh, whatever, but there are important professors of theoretical physics who advocate this with open eyes and strenuously as the future of science. Okay. Can I have 5 more minutes and bring my argument to a... Okay. So, what I told you is that there is the old absolute relational debate, and in its modern form, it is the background-dependent versus background-independent debate. And I argued that as far as quantum gravity is concerned, while there are big problems, like the inverse problem, roughly speaking, the background-independent approach, which takes relationalism seriously, is doing better. Then I turned to the issue of what are elementary particles and how do they get their properties, and I followed down the basic ideas that have guided most research the last 50, 60 years in elementary particle physics, which is certainly embedded in an absolute framework that is elementary particles have properties from their relationship to a fixed and changing background. And I believe it's led to a crisis. And I think that when you have to invoke this logic for your physical theory, you face a crisis. And by the way, I think it's a crisis that philosophers should examine. And I know a few people who are, including at least one person in this room, who are examining it. Okay. So, if I'm right that this is the price of a wrong turn based on an issue that the philosophers are very familiar with, that is the relational absolute debate, I should be able to tell you how the other route that I'm advocating might do better. And that's what I'm going to do in 3 minutes or 5 minutes, and then I'm going to stop. And I don't here have much except hand waving, as we physicists call it. Okay. A relational theory must proceed in the opposite way, not through symmetry, but through asymmetry. Why? Because we can go back to Leibniz's principle of the identity of the indiscernible. Okay. Two entities can be spoken of as distinct from each other if they have distinct sets of relations with the rest of the universe. And therefore, when there is symmetry means you can make some transformation where you move things around and the state remains unchanged. That's the symmetry of a state as opposed to symmetry of laws. When you have a symmetry, okay, you deny the conditions of the principle of the identity of the discernible. You say there are entities that you claim are distinct from each other that, however, have completely identical properties. And this, of course, was part of the basis of Leibniz's criticisms of Newton and the Leibniz-Parr correspondence, whether God could move the universe 10 feet to the left or, you know, to the right in the United States. And that was supposed to be funny. From thinking about what relationalism really means, and I think that the identity of the indiscernibles is a key notion in relationalism and relevant for the present day, If there's a symmetry in your theory, you've made a mistake, because you're trying to claim that there are distinct entities which have the same relations to the rest of the world. Okay? So the universe cannot have any symmetries. One way to talk about this is the following. If you speak of an event, you can speak of one way to speak of the properties of an event in a relational picture is the properties of an event are what you see from that event looking around. And that is, it's all the physical information coming to you at that event, coming up your back with light cone. And if events are distinguished off from each other, there should be no two events in the universe from which what you see when you look around from those two events is the same. And Julian Barber even elevated, gave that principle a name. He called a universe that satisfies that a Leibnizian universe, in some of his writings. Okay. So a universe can't have any symmetries. It can't be in thermal equilibrium if it is a relational universe. Okay. A little parenthesis, hence a relational universe better have mechanisms in it that drives the universe not to a more symmetric, more equilibrium configuration, but to a less symmetric, less equilibrium configuration. And it does. Gravity does that. And of course, that's a whole course on how gravity works in astrophysics. But gravity is the reason why the world is not just a uniform gas in equilibrium. Okay. Are there other mechanisms that drive the universe away from being having lots of symmetry, being in equilibrium? Well, once you have biology, yes, natural selection is such a force, or such a process. Okay? Now, I'll do one side of this quickly, and then the other. Okay? The first claim, the big claim that I'm making here, and it is embedded in a claim about relationalism in physics, is that natural selection, the methodology of the theory of natural selection is a relational methodology. The properties that natural selection deals with, like fitness, are relational properties. An organism or a species has no properties that natural selection addresses in isolation. The properties that natural selection addresses and that mathematical models of natural selection address, like fitness, are relational properties. Okay? So what Darwin was really doing was following the relational strategy and making biology more relational. And indeed, he explicitly went away from the notion that species are absolute, eternal quality, categories to those that are created in time. Okay. Now, the big conjecture here is that maybe this could play out in physics, and maybe this is what we need to get us out of the conundrum that the particle physicists have gotten us into. That is, what we need in physics are mechanisms that not only keep the universe inhomogeneous and out of equilibrium, which gravity does, but keep all the particles distinct from each other and give us an actual spectrum of elementary particles which is quite unsymmetric, which is what the real world looks like, in which every kind of elementary particle has a distinct set of properties. Okay. Now, I'm aware that I'm encroaching on your time. So I think what I'm going to do is just tell you that what happens here is an argument about how to use natural selection in particle physics and cosmology to accomplish what the absolute strategy in particle physics failed to do, which is give a testable explanation of where the properties of the elementary particles come from. I think I'm just going to go there, and I apologize. But if people want, I can address that in the discussion. So I'm skipping over here, just working through the steps of showing you that the relational strategy in the guise of natural selection can actually play a role in particle physics and cosmology and lead to predictions that are testable. So in both instances, that is in the question of elementary particles and where they get their properties and the theory of space and time, there is a relational strategy that people have been carrying out and an absolute strategy that other people have been carrying out. And I claim that the evidence, of course, this is not philosophical evidence. It's the evidence of lots of philosophically naive, highly trained theoretical physicists whirling away at research programs for decades, but that produces a kind of evidence that may be of interest for philosophers. The evidence is that in each of those two domains, the absolute theory fails and does not lead to science which is predictive, and the relational strategy appears to do better. So that's my main claim. And the reason is that the difference is between explanations that refer ultimately to a network of relationships amongst entities with those where everything evolves dynamically versus kinds of explanations that refer to an absolute unchanging background. And my big claim is that both when it comes to what space and time are and when it comes to how elementary particles get their properties, the one strategy is too loose and doesn't lead to good science. And the other one has a better chance, although I'm not claiming it succeeded, but it has a better chance. And the basic, in a nutshell, the reason is that if the way that you explain the properties of entities is to refer to a background and to relationships to the background, and the background is not dynamical, that means it's postulated, and you're free to postulate all the properties of the background you like. If you need more dimensions for more symmetries or for more forces, just add the more dimensions. If you need, you know, whatever you want, you can just postulate. Now, of course, in string theory, there are some rules that tell you what you can postulate and what you can't. And those rules are constrained, and there's only 10 to the 500 solutions of them. Okay? But we happen to, as far as we know, live in a single universe, and that's what we're trying to explain. So my hypothesis, and I don't claim to have demonstrated it, but I hope I've provided some provocative evidence for it, is that Leibniz was much brighter than he knew and that other people knew at the time, because relationalism is not just makes better sense at a fundamental level, that is, you don't get into the conundrums and paradoxes that he accused Clark and Newton of, but it actually, as a research strategy, it's more productive of testable theories. And I'll stop there. Thank you.